Douglas Feldman is a prisoner. If Texas has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where Texas is preparing to put Douglas Feldman to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage and commentary on the killing in Texas, the state responsible for more than a third of all U.S. executions. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, with criminal defense attorneys Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, and Jack Lee. Huntsville reporter outside the death house Gloria Rubeck, Houston vigil reporter Nancy Bailey. Featured interview guest, Professor Franklin Zimrich, author of the essay, The Death Penalty's Dirty Little Secret. The execution watch for Douglas Feldman begins.
Good evening. I am Ray Hill. I'm the host of Execution Watch tonight. We have the full team in here and interesting interviews coming. I just received word from producer Elizabeth Stein that the Supreme Court of the United States, with 30 minutes prior to the execution, denied the last-minute appeal. So Mr. Feldman is in the death chamber being striked down. We have a reporter in Huntsville, our own Otis McClay. Otis?
This is Gloria.
Okay, I'll take Gloria. Gloria, what's going on there? Gloria? Anybody there? Otis? I don't think she went anywhere. I think we lost that. See if you can catch up with that. At any rate, we have reporters, two of them, actually. We have Gloria and Otis in Huntsville at the death chamber, and they're going to give us an analysis of what is happening there. It is not unusual for some of these things to take shape for the last few minutes. Have we got it, Gloria? You back?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
The media has gone in, two media people, Gray Schick with the Associated Press and somebody else, but and the Huntsville Item is out here. Was that a Huntsville? Okay, the Huntsville Item went inside also.
Okay.
But his mother is an invalid and is not going in, so I believe, actually, here comes some people. Who is this coming in?
Are they an escorted party? Gloria? Gloria? Hello, Gloria? Otis, is that you? This cell phone is breaking up. Can somebody with a...
So they've been in communication, and just 6 days ago, Mr. Feldman was bar mitzvahed and I guess came to terms with what's going to happen. There's a number of witnesses going in. I'm not sure if they're family. Is that Kathy? It is.
Okay.
Kathy? Yeah, Kathy Cox just went in.
Kathy Cox just went in. Kathy Cox is a... Salvation Armory, regular missionary to death row, and she is not an infrequent guest and witness of these things.
She visits death row every Thursday and Friday. Would you like to talk to this gentleman from Brooklyn who actually
corresponded with him, the WBAI guy?
The what guy?
WBAI guy.
Yeah, BAI. Okay. Hang on just a minute.
Please. We're talking to Gloria Rubeck. Otis McClay is there, and a WBAI staff person is also there because he has been corresponding with Douglas Feldman for some time. Hello? Anybody there? No, they're passing the phone. I need to figure out how to do that in a more efficient way. But at any rate...
Hello?
Gloria?
Ray?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Ray?
Yes, please.
Oh, hi. Okay, hi. This is James Irsay.
James, and you're with the crack team at WBAI?
The crack team, yeah. We spoke once before some months ago when I first called you to ask you what to expect if I were to be selected.
Oh, I remember that conversation, yes. And,
yeah.
And so what you didn't expect is to get denied the possibility to witness.
I did not, and the reason it happened is because Doug requested me as a spiritual advisor, and when they saw that I wasn't ordained, somehow they did not find it possible to simply put me on the witness list as opposed to the spiritual advisor list. I called them and asked them to do that, but they completely did nothing for me.
Well, I could testify that WBAI has been a spiritual impact on my life for decades. Are you there? Hello? I'm leaving them speechless, apparently. I think that the phone is not working well. Doyle, can you...
My phone.
Hello, anybody there? Hello? I don't think this is working. Doyle, we're going to...
Nothing I can do. I have to call AT&T.
Okay, we're going to forego this. Who we have somebody else on the line? Presumably David. Hello? Nancy. Hello, Nancy. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Well, you're on the air.
Oh, okay. This is Nancy.
Okay, where are you, Nancy?
I'm in front of the Episcopal Church on West Alabama in Houston.
St. Stephen's.
Yes, indeed.
All right. So how many vigilants have we in Houston?
Well, it's kind of thin tonight. There's about five because we've got two members that are out of the state. They are always here. And some of the people who come intermittently have not come tonight. So maybe they're in there hiding in the cold.
Bless your heart. That's not a bad idea, actually. It's kind of stifling out there. I regret to have the news for you that just 30 minutes before 6, about 5:30, the Supreme Court gave their final ex nix in this case, and
yeah.
The witnesses have all crossed the road. So this process is beginning and will continue.
That's bad news, but was not unexpected.
Right. And so can I tell folks that if anybody wants to keep up with the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, that what they should do is go to an acronym of that, TCDADP.
TCADP.org is the website.
TCADP.org.
TCADP.org.
Okay.
And then on that site, if they're in other areas or depending on what area there are some other contact emails that may be closer to their locality, including Houston, which comes to me.
Okay. Thank you, Nancy.
Well, it's good to talk to you.
Give my love to the other vigilants.
I certainly will do that.
Thank you, ma'am.
And, bye-bye.
And so that covers it. Usually we get from the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. We get Gloria Ruback, who is in Huntsville, actually is connected with the organization, the Abolition Movement Against Texas Death Penalty, and their website is theabolitionmovement.org. I believe James is back. James, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Have you a more reliable cell phone?
Apparently, that's what they tell me.
Okay. You know Douglas Feldman. He is still alive. He won't be in about a half hour, but he's still alive. What was that like for you?
Well, it was an experience, for sure. He contacted me because he saw from a magazine, a Judaica exhibition catalog that I knew about Judaism and specifically that I knew about Kabbalah. He expressed great interest in it because he was reconnecting with his Jewish roots.
I understand he was just bar mitzvahed this last week.
he was bar mitzvah just last week. I spoke with, and in fact met with, Rabbi Goldstein, who performed the bar mitzvah. He told me that Doug was very moved by the ceremony, and in fact, when they tied the tefillin around him, which is phylacteries, a part of the Jewish ritual, Doug actually burst out in tears. He was so moved by the experience.
Well, you have traveled a long way. Are you going to be able to spend some time with your sister station before you're able to go back?
I wish I could, Ray, but I have to go back to my home station. I'm on the air a Friday morning.
Oh, okay.
As much as I'd love to visit T, but I won't, unfortunately, have the time.
Well, James, down here we're beginning like a new movement. The End of Mass Incarceration Movement, and you can find us on Facebook.
Where yeah, we talk, I've seen it.
We talk about issues like executions and mandatory minimum sentences and the drug war laws and all of that. Why don't you stay in touch with me at home and give me an opportunity to chat with your audiences about that?
Absolutely. I'll do that, Ray. Thanks.
Bon voyage back. Meet the nice folks there that are vigilants at the death house are always interesting people to meet.
Yes, I've been speaking with many of them.
Thank you, James.
Bye, Ray.
Bye-bye. Well, Jim, this is an interesting story.
It's kind of a gory story. What happened, to those who are not familiar with Texas, this all took place in Collin County, which is a little county just south of Dallas. It's in North Texas. And there's a 40-year-old man named Douglas Fellman, who's a financial analyst, so he wasn't your typical, what you call, street person. Had gone on a crime spree, and basically, here's what happened. On day one of his crime spree, for some strange reason, he goes by a Volkswagen dealership, I believe in Richardson, Irving, somewhere around Dallas. He uses a pistol, he shoots up the store window, shoots up a bunch of cars, does about $8,000 worth of damage. And according to him, the only contact he had with his dealership was some 10 years earlier they worked on his car. He just decided to shoot the place up. Then the following day, the following night, this occurred on day one. On day two, late at night, he's riding a Harley-Davidson motorcycle on Highway 75 going toward Dallas. He's in the right-hand lane. It's a four-lane pavement. And an 18-wheeler goes by him. He claims driving very fast, 70 or 75 miles an hour, and whips in front of him. This enrages him. He empties a 9mm pistol in the trailer of the 18-wheeler, and it doesn't stop. So when it does stop, he reloads his pistol, goes back up, then unloads another round, several rounds inside the cab, and kills the truck driver. Didn't know who he was. He was enraged because the man had cut in front of him in the traffic. And then what he did at that point, he made sure the guy was dead. He said he wanted to make sure he was dead. He gets back on his motorcycle and heads home. On the way home, he goes by an Exxon service station. When he goes by an Exxon service station, there's a Hispanic man by the name of Nicholas Vasquez. He's just finished loading up a load of gas, dumping some gas in the service station tanks. He's heading back to his truck, but he's next to an 18-wheeler. And Fellman goes up to him and shoots him twice in the back and kills him. So he kills two truck drivers within the space of about a half an hour apart. And apparently he claimed he was enraged because of what the first truck driver did to him. A week later, he's in his Range Rover car.
Nobody caught him?
Nope. Nobody caught him. If he doesn't know, if you get enraged about this kind of conduct in Houston, you'd be killing everybody because the people are always cut in front of you here. Better not be from Houston. But what happened about a week later, he goes by a little convenience store, and there was a man next to an 18-wheeler using the telephone, and he shoots him a couple of times in the back but doesn't kill him. At this point, a witness sees his license plate number, gets the license plate number, he's quickly apprehended. When he's apprehended, he has on him a 9mm pistol he used in the two prior murders and this shooting, had a Glock pistol with some over 200 rounds of ammunition with him, plus several pistol magazines. And it reminded you almost kind of like a baby Columbine, one of those things where he was pretty well loaded for bear. What happens, then he's arrested and charged with the two murders, and they're seeking the death penalty because it's got the multiple murders that are committed. Now, to make matters worse, you think things couldn't get worse. He writes the detective who's investigating this case, And he admits that he's the one that shot up the Volkswagen dealership. He admits that he killed both men.
They had not previously made that connection?
No, didn't previously known him. He writes him a letter. And he admits shooting up the Volkswagen dealership, admits the killing of both men, all three truck drivers. Said he did it because he was enraged and angry. He admitted doing that. And then to add more misery to trying to defend this case, he writes a letter admitting it. During trial, he decides to take the stand. And testifying in front of the jury, he admits all of this. He claimed that he admitted every bit of all the killings, all the shootings, plus many more things that Susan will talk about that came up at punishment. He admitted all this in front of the jury. And what is basically what he told the jury, he was enraged. As a matter of fact, he, when he's in front of the jury testifying, he said he was still enraged about the conduct of these truck drivers. And so you have a situation where there's absolutely no doubt about guilt. Because he confesses to the police voluntarily, I might add.
And then is somebody going to explain to me how he got on the witness stand in his trial?
Unfortunately, Ray, that's a decision that's solely within the discretion of the defendant. If the lawyer tells him he can't do it and advises him not to, it is the defendant's choice to do so.
Don't they have to prepare a record of that?
They don't have to prepare a record. What you normally
do. A lawyer would insist that they prepare a record.
Well, usually what lawyers are going to do, there's several ways to go about that. What you do is have a hearing in front of the jury and advise your client in front of the jury. I mean, advise you outside the presence of the jury. Advise your client that not to take the stand. He's doing it on his own. And I would imagine that in this particular case, that it was very much against advice of counsel, but it's a foregone conclusion. In fact, they returned a verdict of guilty in 24 minutes after they heard all of this.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, there was a whole big bunch of stuff that came in on punishment. Susan's going to discuss what came in on punishment even
okay.
more.
We go to Susan.
Okay, what comes in on punishment are there are numerous previous instances of offenses and instances of what you would call gratuitous violence against other people. So there's actually way too many to go through, but what comes across, what comes across in these previous instances is that this man has a lot of anger and rage and he just explodes against other people. For what he believes or what he perceives to be a provocation. One instance kind of illustrates it. He goes to a fast food place. There's a car hop that comes out. He orders his food. A car hop brings the food. He tells the car hop that he doesn't have his wallet. She says she's not going to give him the food. And she, as she goes away, goes to leave, he ends up, running her down with his car. She's thrown 20 feet. He runs her over. She has serious and permanent injuries. So really what happens is he seems to have an extreme explosive kind of rage in him, and that comes out.
Not the sort of thing that anger management will do much with initially.
I'm not a psychiatrist, but, I mean, clearly something would be very off in this person. Because a lot of these instances, he's perceiving it as a provocation, although these would be normal things that wouldn't really provoke a normal person. So, but then really what he does is, in the punishment phase of the trial, what comes out is when he was awaiting trial and he was in jail, he started communicating with a former girlfriend by phone and by mail. And so there was a series of about 81 letters that he had sent to her. And the type of things he wrote in the letters were, it later came out at trial at the punishment phase because the former girlfriend told an investigator and basically she turned the letters over to the DA's office and this came out at the punishment phase of trial. But what came out in excerpts of his letters were that he said that he enjoyed killing Everett and Vasquez, that he wanted to see more people get shot. He described fantasizing about killing police officers because he was angry over a ticket he had received from an officer. He also said he fantasized about killing shopkeepers that had angered him in the past. And he said that he believed more people should be killed. and that he explained he wanted to kill people who disturbed his quiet and desecrate their corpses. He also referred to the jury as a bunch of fat, ignorant slobs. And he compared killing humans to hunting down game animals in one of his letters. And that basically is what the prosecution closed their punishment phase of the trial with, is his letters.
Mercy.
And the prosecution, I guess, read the excerpts in.
Sounds pretty persuasive. Right?
And I guess after they got in all the experts, they said, "Well, you know, rest."
When Execution Watch, Mr. Feldman indicated that he wanted to be interviewed by the Execution Watch team. And when we get a request like that, you guys on death row, if you get a date, you'll get a letter from Elizabeth saying, "Do you want to interview for your Execution Watch show?" And so we packed up and we drove to Livingston, to the Polanski unit. And when we got inside, we were told by the guards that Mr. Feldman had come to the visit room. Now, we had three interviews scheduled that day. One of those that we were to interview decided not to come down. And that's certainly an option they have even the day of the interview. And one of the guys did come down. And Mr. Feldman came down, but according to what the other inmate that I interviewed told me, that the guards started in on him when he left his cell. Now, you understand that I don't know any of this. I'm not giving testimony. I am hearing from another inmate said that the guards picked on him all the way down, and by the time he got down to the visit room, he was wound, quote, tighter than a $3 watch, end quote, and that he just went off and he tried to tell the... Now, in all of the news media stories leading up to this execution, that story has been in it, but you never know who the media team was that was going to interview in, and it was us. It was Execution Watch. Larry, what's your piece of this puzzle?
I'm just going to talk for a few minutes, Ray, about jury selection in capital cases. And as you know, in order to serve on any jury, a person has to take an oath, among other things, saying you'll follow the law. So the jury selection process is a series of questions where lawyers ask a lot of questions, lawyers, judges ask a lot of questions regarding whether the person can follow the law. And that's one of the determining factors. Now, in a capital murder case, where the death penalty is being sought, then the process is a lot different than in a misdemeanor or a regular felony, in that the jury selection process, there is a phase. Well, first of all, a lot more panelists are called over. And there is a general phase where there are general questions asked among the whole panel as a whole. And then there are the individual questions that are asked to individual jurors that other jurors cannot hear. And so the judge and the two lawyers get to ask those questions. They also, once the challenges for cause, among other things, the people who cannot follow the law or those kinds of things, and so they would be dismissed for cause. Beyond that, if either lawyer, the prosecutor or the defense lawyer, want to remove a person from the prospective jury panel, then they have to use their strikes, what we call preemptive challenges.
And they only have so many strikes, both sides.
They only have so many strikes. And in the capital murder case where the death penalty is sought, they have a lot more. They've got 15 rather than either 3 in a misdemeanor or 10 in a felony. In this case, you have 15. And so you have to use your strikes carefully to make sure you get rid of those people that you want to get rid of. And in order to perfect error, if a person believes that a juror got on the panel over his objection, that is a challenge for cause, to perfect error in the denial of a challenge for cause, what the person has to do is, first of all, try to get the challenge for cause agreed to by the judge. The judge does not, then you have to use one of your strikes to get rid of him. And then ask for more strikes. the judge gives you more strikes, then there's no error.
Oh, okay. You can accumulate strikes as the day goes on.
You can ask for more.
Yeah.
Okay, and if you ask for more and you get more and you still run out of strikes to get rid of the person that you wanted to get rid of, you still got to use a strike on that person. And then you've got to identify someone who actually made it on the jury and said, I would have struck him, but for the fact that I ran out of strikes.
Okay.
And he went through all of those that set of procedures, and for whatever reason, there were some who were still objectionable to him. Also, when the whole process of removing a person for cause is one that goes back and forth. If a person, if a prospective juror says, I cannot follow that law, then if he says that definitively, then he has to be removed for cause unless he's rehabilitated. And the rehabilitation process is one of, well, what if, you know, like the Maxwell Smart kind of thing. Well, what about, have you thought about this? What if this were to have happened? What if that were to have happened? And so you try to rehabilitate that person where they say, well, in that case, we're not talking about this case right here, but in an appropriate case, if this were to have occurred, could you follow the law in that case? And if they say, yes, I can follow the law in that case, then they have been rehabilitated.
And both the defense and the prosecution has a crack at rehabilitation.
They have the opportunity to do so if they desire it. And they don't have to if they feel like the person has been fully rehabilitated. If they feel the person is still a good – each side has the opportunity to decide – whether I accept this juror or not.
Now, there's one exception to that rule, Larry. If a prospective jury expresses a bias toward the defendant, you cannot rehabilitate that person.
Right.
It's gone.
Right,
you
right.
You don't rehabilitate that.
Right. And so in that case, where there's the clear bias
against the defendant.
Okay, well, that cannot be rehabilitated. You can't say, well, what if this or what if it? Well, no, he's already
expressed the bias. There is no what if in that situation.
Not in that situation.
Now, is this process significantly different between the various states?
Quite a bit different. A lot of it depends upon what kind of structures you have, on what punishment issues you've got. For example, we're going to talk to later on a professor from California, and they got some statutory mitigating factors that jurors have got to consider during a punishment hearing. And Texas doesn't have a list of statutory mitigating factors, and what this means is real simple. If I'm going to have you on the jury, can you consider X, Y, Z, B as the one to mitigate? For example, age, youthful offenders. I have a whole list of factors. If you couldn't consider them, you're not qualified. You can't do that in Texas.
Well, and from what you just got through saying, I got the impression that not only does it vary between state to state, but it varies between case to case.
Exactly. Exactly. And see, it's done. And here's the thing about it. And it's different than picking a jury. What happens, they bring in usually a panel of about 10 people, and they don't see each other. So we're talking to you.
Yeah.
At the end of questioning you, the state's got to either accept you or reject you. Because when we all get finished, the judge will look at the prosecutor, and if you say we accept him, then it's my decision to accept or reject. We got to do it right then, in front of that juror. We don't know what's coming behind us. So if you get to a case where you've used 14 strikes, you're down and got one left, you got to be real careful because you may get some horrible person come along later you're going to be stuck with. It's kind of like it's really a big crapshoot.
All right. Speaking of California professors, we have, could you get Professor Zimmering on? Professor Franklin Zimmering is the William G. Simon Professor of Law and the Wolfson Distinguished Scholar at the University of California Berkeley School of Law. And he has recently published an essay, The Death Penalty's Dirty Little Secret. Professor, thank you very much for being on Execution Watch.
Well, under other circumstances, I'd say my pleasure. But given the context, I think that's not quite true.
Well, I bothered to go on the Internet. She lays there to be obedient to me, and I found out that as of January this year, there are 727 death row inmates in California's death row, and Texas has only 300, but I suspect it's because we kill a lot of them.
Oh, you're quite right about that. If you want to go back to 1995, when I first compared the two states, the death rows were identically sized at about 395. And over the next 6 years, from January 1st, 1995 till the end of 2001, Texas had 127 executions. California had six. So it was, and this is controlling for death sentences, it was a 27-to-1 ratio. Given the juries had given death sentences, your chances of getting executed were vastly greater in Texas than in California. And then, over the next 10 years, that gap widened. Instead of 27-to-1, over the decade that began in 2002, the gap became 44-to-1. So there are tremendous differences in execution rates and risks, which are completely independent of whether prosecutors charge capital crimes, whether there are capital trials, and whether there are death sentences. And they're unbelievably large.
Well, I would be hard-pressed to try to defend Texas's awkward position in the statistical race here, but I would like to point out that in 2012, no one was sentenced to death from Harris County, which historically has been the most frequent supplier of bodies for death row sales.
Oh, absolutely. That one of the things that is going on in Texas and all over the rest of the country is that there has been significant drops in death sentences and in the add-ons to death row. But and I would say that in Texas, not only Harris County, but also in Dallas, and in each case associated with a change in management in prosecution, there have been very big decline.
You mean there's a difference between the Wade management and the current administration in Dallas County?
Absolutely. So that the feeder ramp has slowed down tremendously. But the problem is that there's a lag of 10 or 12 years before that feeds directly into executions, unless there are also changes in the judicial and political and executive environment of the state, and so far there haven't been. Now, look, if you want to be fair to Texas, a large part of California's paucity of executions is that we have ambivalent and pretty careful judicial involvement, at least at the federal courts. But there are states which are just as execution prone as Texas. They're just a little bit smaller. And you don't have to go far.
Professor,
they're all in the South.
Professor, we've just got a news bulletin from Huntsville. May I take a moment to get
Surely.
A report from that on the scene reporter? Doyle, put the professor on hold. Let me go to Gloria, please. Gloria, have you something to report?
Yes, Ray. Doug Selma has been murdered by the state of Texas. His friends and witnesses have come out of the death house. And there's about, I guess, 15 of us out here, and, are we being broadcast live, Ray?
We are being broadcast live. People on death row can hear you.
Okay, so to all of Doug's friends on death row, we send our sympathy. This was obviously a very disturbed man. a man who should have been treated for his mental health issues and not be murdered by the state of Texas. So we're sorry for your loss. And I have a feeling that Doug was not an easy person to get along with. But bless his heart, he will no longer have those problems thanks to Governor Perry.
Now, you want to explain what happens to his body now, or do you want me to?
Well, his body... Actually, I'm not sure what the family's plans are for the body.
Okay, well, let me...
Wait, here, he knows. Just a minute.
Okay.
Yes, Doug, having just been bar mitzvahed, will be given a Jewish burial with the help of Rabbi Goldstein, who bar mitzvahed him, and he will be, I believe, helped by Jewish Family Services and be interred in a cemetery in Dallas.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate that. Gloria? Gloria?
Yes, Ray.
Tell people how they can get in touch with you and your organization.
Okay, our organization is the Death Penalty Abolition Movement. We actually meet next Tuesday night, and I'm delighted to say that for the month of August, there are no damn executions happening.
Isn't that good news? We go all the way to September.
Yeah, and then so anyway, abolitionmovement.org is our website, and we meet at the Shape Community Center on Live Oak in Alabama at 7 o'clock Tuesday night. We're going to have a couple of guests, the mother of Erica Shepherd, the longest-serving woman on death row, will be joining us. Erica's having some real severe health problems compounded by the idiots that are the guards over there who are...
Gloria, I've got to get back to my interview, but thank you very much for that report.
Okay. All right. Bye-bye. Okay.
Just for your information, Professor and all, understand that if the family has requested an immediate viewing with the body, the contractor, Carnes Funeral Service, will take the body from the death chamber on a gurney and carry it to a nearby church facility where the family may touch the body while it is still warm. I know that sounds morbid, macabre, but the fact of the matter is, this person has not had a human touch since they have been on death row. And that is true of all death row inmates. And the ritual of going for a quick family viewing was something instituted by Mr. Carnes when he got that contract. And it happens in every case where the family requests it. Sorry about that, bringing people up to date, Professor. I'm in the studio here with me. I have Jim Skelton, who read with interest your essay. Jim, do you have any question for Doc?
Yes, I am curious about one thing. One thing I wish you would have done in your article was discuss the different appellate procedure in California vis-a-vis the appellate procedure in Texas. And the second thing I would like to have seen is the way the issue of life or death is submitted to juries. For example, in Texas, we do it by special issues, and I'd like for you to explain to our audience how it's submitted to a jury in California.
Well, you see, in a funny sense, if you're talking about the study that the announcer is, we don't consider that because we start with active death sentences. All of the comparisons between California and Texas that you read there are what happens after a capital sentence. And
how
so
about
what we're interested
procedure?
In is why there is a 45 times greater death rate. What you find out about state appellate procedures in California is that after three of the seven judges on the California Supreme Court were removed by the voters in 1986, a so-called court unpacking plan, California's Supreme Court, which gets direct file, that is to say there's no intermediate appellate court, there's only the Supreme Court after a death verdict is is delivered.
Professor, does California Supreme Court have both criminal and civil jurisdiction?
It sure does, and so you don't have a criminal appeals court as a separate one. You have the Supreme Court doing both, and doing both, I'll point out in a minute, very slowly. But what happened because you had this court unpacking was that the Supreme Court of the state of California went from almost 75% reversal of death sentences, not necessarily of guilty verdicts, but of death sentences before this 1986 removal, to 90% affirmances of both conviction and sentence. And to put it in a compared to Texas frame, it turns out that for the first 10 years of the study that I'm talking about, the California affirmance rate was significantly higher than that of the Texas courts. So that the huge gap in execution risk wasn't accountable to that.
Not to the state courts, but then you've got the Ninth Circuit, and we've got Edith Jones over here.
Yeah, well, that's part of the story. But I have to remind you that Arizona's got the same Ninth Circuit and has 10 times the execution rate as California does. What the California Supreme Court does, and because I have to say that state courts are a large part of the difference, but what the court does is politically much safer than reversing cases, and that is it engages in endless delay. It can literally be...
Is that a conscious court strategy, or is that something that just kind of comes over the transom?
Well, how much truth serum are you going to administer when I ask that question to the state Supreme Court?
Well,
I think it's a little bit of both.
Okay.
I'm curious about one thing, Professor. If you can give me an idea about how long can a case stay on direct appeal from your trial court to your Supreme Court? Is there an average year, 2 years, 3 years?
No. Oh, yes. We're talking more than a decade.
Okay,
First of all, it's going to take 4 or 5 years before there's an attorney appointed.
Ah! So there's an upfront delay. Well, you know, we've got all these deadlines around here, including one somewhat famous deadline, Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, that you cannot file a last-minute brief after 5 o'clock. You remember that
case? Of course. Yeah. And these are the systematic uses. And you see, it is exactly in these kinds of operations, one after the other after the other. What you have... And it's not just in Texas. It was Texas and Oklahoma now.
Yeah.
States like Virginia and Florida had pretty good head starts until there were political changes. But what you have in the Texas-Oklahoma setting is a perfect storm of a whole series of things which are stacked to reduce delay, and to create not overwhelming affirmances, but enough affirmances fast enough so that there is a steady supply of executions. And then here comes the bad news about Harris County. That's a steady supply of executions which can go on for years, 8 or 9 years, after there has been a dramatic drop in the supply.
Professor, I want to thank you very much for coming on Execution Watch. You know, in radio, the clock is God. And I've got some other business to take care of. But we've been talking to Professor Franklin Zimring, who is with the University of California, Berkeley School of Law. I have actually been on your campus, by the way. By the way, one of the greatest blessings of my life is that I'm not a lawyer, but right in second place is that I'm not a professor either. I'm just a radio guy. And we appreciate your being with us. We will call you again.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much, Professor. And that was where we had Jack, you brought a piece of this puzzle. Mike, Jack, who's next?
Yeah, I was going to talk about, follow up on what Larry was talking about. Specifically, I was going to talk about, the questions that are asked on this special issue here in Texas to jurors, whether or not they can go along with the death penalty or not. The Lodestone case here is the Witherspoon v. Illinois. What happened in that case was the Supreme Court basically came down and said, look, if you have a split in people, Illinois had a law that said if in order to serve on a death penalty jury, this is 19 mid-1960s. In order to serve on a death penalty jury, you had to be pro-death penalty. That anybody who had conscientious scruples against applying the death penalty would not be able to could be struck for cause. Well, the Supreme Court came back and said, no, you can't do that, because there is a part of the community, there is a part of the population that conscientiously objects to the death penalty. And so you can't simply exclude everybody for these conscientious scruples. Now, if you can demonstrate that under no circumstances would they apply the death penalty, sure, you can strike them because they simply can't apply the law. Well, then later on in 1984, there was another case which explained that quite a bit better, Wainwright v. Witt. This is a Florida case. What happened there, the Supreme Court came and said, all right, if somebody is iffy about the death penalty but not certain one way or another, that it's not necessarily a strike. If you look at the ruling, what the Supreme Court was trying to do was give the trial court more discretion in being able to pick in order to be able to strike jurors or to keep them on depending on how they respond. And effectively what's happened there is the Supreme Court was trying to build a better mousetrap. Witherspoon v. Illinois was a bit too broad, and they decided to ratchet that back a little bit with Wainwright v. Witt.
In actual practice, has this changed the dynamic?
Sure, of course, I'm sure it has, because what's happened is that you don't, anybody who is, affirmatively, conscientiously, you know, saying, no, I don't like the death penalty, that rule still applies from Wainwright. From Witherspoon. However, what you end up seeing a lot of is rehabilitation and the use of hypotheticals to rehabilitate.
Tidy up.
Exactly. That's exactly right. For example, a hypothetical, you know, a prosecution will come out and say, all right, well, are you pro-death penalty or anti, how do you feel about applying the death penalty? Well, I don't know how many people would go out and say, yeah, I think that's a great idea. I think we should do it more often. On the other hand,
I think I heard something like that in Alice's restaurant.
So what you, very few people are actually going to say that. And those, so what ends up happening is they'll give you a bunch of hypotheticals. Well, if you saw somebody doing this, doing that, the range of punishment was life imprisonment or death. And the law specified that. Could you apply the law?
Thank you, Jack. And now we're going to check with Mike Gillespie and see what he has brought to the party today. I need to remind the listeners that Douglas Feldman is dead. The state of Texas killed him at approximately 6:30 today. The witnesses returned to their nesting place where they were held before they crossed the road, letting us know the procedure had begun. This is Ray Hill. We're on Execution Watch. What you got, Mike?
What I'm here to talk about is there was an appellate point brought up to overrule his case based upon his mental condition. And I think it was interesting, we heard your people at Huntsville talk about this man has got mental issues. Obviously got mental issues. The question is how these mental issues affect his trial. The point that was brought up in the appellate court was that his lawyer did not introduce evidence of his mental condition. Now, what his mental condition was, he was diagnosed before this with bipolar. Well, the problem with bipolar is a popular word. Bipolar is a catch-all that we're all using for people who have no self-control. The problem is bipolar is a serious condition that affects 4% of the population.
Yeah, it has been referred to as schizophrenia.
Exactly. And it comes from being depressed, manic depression, to a maniac high state. Polar is depression. Bipolar is going back and forth between the highs and the lows. So obviously this person had a problem. The legal issue was his lawyer knew about it. His lawyer was told about it. Why didn't his lawyer bring his evidence into court? Well, if you can remember last time on this show, I had the same issue with an appellant on why didn't the lawyer bring this point up. And at that time, it didn't work because the lawyer did not lay out an affidavit of his trial strategy of why he did not bring this evidence in. In this case, his lawyer laid out his trial strategy, gave an affidavit to the appellate court explaining why he did not call in these issues. Based upon that, the appellate court said it's okay. It was a trial decision. Now, why did that lawyer decide not to do it? Well, the lawyer decided not to do it because he had people who he knew who were doctors examine this client, and his client acted out, was not able to be interviewed. After talking to his doctors, he decided that this is not a good strategy. And the reason not a good strategy is two things. Number one, if his doctors took the stand and testified to the condition of his client, he would be opening up his doctors to cross-examination by the state.
Which all the resistance to interview would have come out, all the acting out in that.
Exactly correct. Then in addition, he was afraid that the state would bring in their doctors to testify how dangerous people like him are. So what he did is he made a decision not to introduce the evidence. That becomes okay by the appellate court because the appellate court gives a trial attorney discretion on how he wants to handle his case.
But didn't this guy take the stand himself?
He took the stand himself. We do not know from the record, did the lawyer try to stop him? We're assuming the lawyer tried to talk him out of it, but the problem is you cannot stop a client from taking the stand. If a man wants to take the stand, he can take the stand to defend himself.
Don't beat on the
lawyer,
table.
Lawyer can't stop that.
Okay? You can't. I mean, that is a deal that the judge presents to your client around you.
That's correct.
Are there any other things in these trials where you circumvent the lawyer and go straight to the client?
Normally, no.
Okay.
No.
Well, the other thing about this, which is interesting, is that even though this lawyer decided not to use his evidence, and I'm not saying that's a bad decision, but the unique part about this is what do you have to lose? I mean, this is such a bad case. He's going to be found guilty. He's going to get the death penalty. What do you have to lose by opening the door to mental illness? My position is he had nothing to lose. But more important than that, my position is that the only justification in a Christian society for the death penalty is a detriment against crime. That's the reason for it. It's got to be a detriment for other people not to do it. I personally think by opening up this mental issue, which is about lack of self-control, maybe other people with this condition
can see that... Apparently that lack of self-control was not materially helped in the tight, regulated society in prison, to wit, my visit and the phones.
One thing, Ray, that I mentioned to Michael earlier, that I think the problem you've got with this particular case, you've got to minimize all these senseless shootings.
The jury would kill him anyway.
Well, I understand that. So you've got nothing to lose to try to shoot a home run. What I would have done had it been me, I would have introduced the evidence of the bipolar disorder at punishment. You know, argue, look, he was born this way. He didn't ask to be bipolar. This is how nature made him. And so as a result, you want to minimize his conduct as best you can, saying this is just the way nature worked. And that's better than nothing. And you try to minimize the horror of this by showing he's mentally ill.
But you got no guarantee that's going to work with that.
Well, in this particular case, it's the only thing you've got. And you're not going to, this case you cannot hurt. It's like having a real ugly woman. If she has a wart, you're not going to notice a wart because she's ugly all over.
But it could work on a case that was not so deadly with murders. It could work in a fistfight, in a rage.
It's a Hail Mary pass. Is that what you're telling me?
And more important, what I believe is that if this man had a mental condition, and his mental condition was lack of control, and the lack of control led to these acts, that's part of the story. You can't just hide that part of the story from society.
And the next thing you got to follow that up with, Michael, none of you got to prove he's a mentally disturbed. You got to give the jury some hope he's going to not be a danger. So then you want to follow it with the psychiatrist saying, look, I can do the following X, Y, Z to keep him under control.
Then you have the problem of telling the jury, if you don't execute him, we have to keep him under counseling and medication for the rest of his life. And so it's a two-edged sword.
Yeah, I got to talk to the audience here. The lawyers on this show work especially hard. You've heard some of that tonight. My name is Ray Hill, and what you've been listening to for the last hour is Execution Watch. The story on Wednesday the 31st, July 2013, Douglas Feldman, 55, was executed today at approximately 6:30 during the production of the show. I am Ray Hill. I'm an ex-convict. And for 30 years, I hosted and produced The Prison Show. And our legal analyst, our lead legal analyst, Jim Skelton, who does all the reading and puts it all together, and then he shares it with the other lawyers, each of which does a vital role in bringing to you the information you need to know to understand that the state has killed Douglas Feldman. Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, the guy with the great voice, Michael Gillespie, who anguishes over each case beautifully, and Jack Lee, who tries as best he can to bring you the Joe Friday Just the Facts guy, but he gets really excited about procedural stuff. Our interview tonight was from Professor Franklin Zimmering from the University of California Berkeley School of Law. We couldn't do this show without Doyle. Somewhere in Austin is our wizard, Otis McClay. Gloria Ruback reported from here. Nancy reported from the demonstration here in Houston. And, of course, all of this is possible because of our wonderful producer, Elizabeth Stein. My name is Ray Hill, and the music you hear comes from Victoria Panetti. And you can reach her by going to Facebook, shemonster.org.